despair. Afghan people hold the US and its Western allies responsible for their plight. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke at the last day of the think tank Valdai International Discussion Club, which took place in Sochi Mountains. Presidential plenary session lasted a few hours, where 140 experts, politicians and diplomats from 42 countries of Eurasia, Africa, North and South America presented their reports and discussed questions on the most painful and sharp topics. Russian President called on the West, which imposes the rules of the game on everyone, to get rid of colonial thinking.
In general, our colleagues from the United States not only set the rules, but also teachers should implement them and how. This is all done in an openly boorish manner. This is all a manifestation of colonial thinking. They say, you must, you are obliged, we are seriously warning you. Who are you anyway? Maybe it's time for you to get rid of your arrogance. I'd like to say, wipe your eyes.
According to the president, Russia faces the task of building a new world. The West ignored the statements of Russia about the inadmissibility of Ukraine's entry into NATO, the expansion of the alliance, and was cynical about previous agreements on Ukraine, which were concluded to resolve the conflict and used as a way to gain time instead of restoring peace. Putin advised them simply put aside pride and not to look at others as savages.
War, a natural war against Donbas, was launched and no one counted the dead children in Donbas. The war started by the Kiev regime with the active direct support of the West is now in its 10th year and a special military operation is aimed at stopping it.
Putin mentioned that special military operation in Ukraine will go until the tasks are completed while Russia has enough power to continue its fight. There will be no compromise with such Ukraine as it is now, and if there will be a threat to Russia's existence, even from conventional weapons, the Russian state can use nuclear weapons.
The United States only signed a document banning nuclear weapons tests, but Moscow, unlike the United States, signed it and ratified it. In case of a retaliatory strike, so many hundreds of our missiles shall appear that not a single enemy will have a chance of survival.
The speech of the Russian president at the Valdai International venue is a significant event and has serious international significance. This year's speech covered major global issues. This year, Putin has paid special attention to the balance of power in the world and individual regions, sending clear messages to the West, which still hopes to defeat Russia in the Ukrainian theater of operation. Putin emphasized that this is impossible for a number of reasons. I think that both friendly countries and enemies of Russia received clear answers to how Russia views current economic and political processes.
This year's anniversary of the International Discussion Club Valdai is the 20th. The main theme of this year's sessions are fair multipolarity and how to ensure security and development for all. Experts discussed the role of nuclear weapons, global economic prospects, as well as energy and food crisis. Марина Картунова, Красная Поляна, Сочи.
This is how Nida and her sister, Zinat, both students of secondary school in Kabul, spend their mornings. They sit in front of their TV and follow the lessons of Maktab Khana, a program launched by Sahar Afghanistan TV channel, affiliated with Iran Sahar Network. Maktab Khana, which means home schooling in Persian, covers different subjects from secondary school. The students can watch the lessons on TV or access them online through the channel's website and social media platforms.
A friend of mine introduced the homeschooling program on Sahar TV to me. Since then, I have been following our lessons every day. It helps us learn from home. Its schedule, teachers, and syllabus are great. I recommend all my peers listen and watch this program at a time when we can't attend our classes at school.
Sahar Afghanistan TV channel says it is trying to fill the gap created by the closure of schools, especially for girls who are banned from attending classes by the Taliban. This program is also said to be the best of its kind, benefiting from prominent teachers, high graphic and engaging methods.
The Taliban decision to ban girls from going to school not only moves Afghan girls backward, but has also concerned Afghan families. So, as a media outlet, Sahar Afghanistan TV channel found it necessary to provide Afghan students with educational programs, initiating the homeschooling program. It is going to be a ray of hope for both female and male students in Afghanistan.
The program was launched based on a realistic and functioning strategy. The top Afghan instructors are teaching in the program. The best visual qualities and an engaging method, as well as a student-friendly environment, are used in the program so that the students enjoy and like it.
The homeschooling program has received positive feedback from many Afghan students, parents, and educators, who see it as a lifeline for learning in a time of crisis.
I thank Sahar Afghanistan TV for launching Maktab Khana. It is a lifeline for many students who are eager to learn. It also helps them learn in a creative way and proceed with their education.
Taliban authorities banned Afghan girls from attending secondary and high schools 2 years ago. Since then, Afghan students have been struggling to find and try alternative ways of learning. In a country where millions of students are deprived of education, Sahar Afghanistan TV channel's homeschooling program represents a ray of hope. Afghan students welcome the program, calling for an urgent reopening of high schools for girls. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Islamabad has stepped up its efforts to geotag and track an estimated 1.73 million undocumented Afghan immigrants in Pakistan. The decision came days after back-to-back bombings in the country's Balochistan and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces, which left over 60 people dead. The Interior Minister Sarfaraz Bughti announced a November 1 deadline for those residing in the country illegally to leave, after which they will be deported by law enforcement agencies. This comes amid claims by Islamabad that 14 out of 24 suicide bombings in the country this year were carried out by Afghan nationals.
There are attacks on us from Afghanistan, and Afghan nationals are involved in those attacks. We have evidence present for that. Businesses and properties of all illegal immigrants will be confiscated, and illegal business operators and their facilitators will be prosecuted in the crackdown.
Pakistan has received the largest influx of Afghan refugees since the Soviet invasion of their country back in 1979. Another wave of immigrants started entering in Pakistan in 2021 after the Taliban took over Kabul and the U.S. troops withdrew from Afghanistan.
These illegal Afghans living in Pakistan for so many years are now basically indulging in anti-state activities. Many of them have been found involved in terrorist attacks in Pakistan. They were harboring terrorists. They were facilitating terrorism in Pakistan.
Meanwhile, experts say Kabul needs to show serious efforts in controlling militants on its soil from attacking Pakistan.
Pakistan urged the interim Afghan government not to allow its soil to be used against Pakistan. Unfortunately, the Afghan government has not been able to carry out its commitment on restraining those elements, on controlling those elements who are involved in the terrorist activities in Pakistan.
The ruling Taliban government of Afghanistan has slammed Islamabad's decision to expel undocumented Afghan nationals, saying Afghan refugees are not involved in the attacks which have taken place in Pakistan.
The influx of illegal immigrants underscores the need for coordinated international measures to address the difficulties that Afghan people are fleeing. The decision by Pakistan to deny entry to the people coming from Afghanistan is further proof that a more sustainable solution to the refugee crisis is needed. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
On honoring slain journalist Shireen Abu Akla, the prominent Palestinian-American journalist who was assassinated by Israeli forces last year, women journalists came together in the northeastern city of Mashhad to send a strong message that women's full participation in public and political life is essential in addressing the multiple crises mankind is confronting in today's world. The International Khurshid Media Festival became the platform for these independent women journalists to share their experiences and thoughts on stories rarely covered by mainstream media. And some outstanding media reports were also awarded. The woman behind it all, American-Iranian broadcaster and Press TV host Marzia Hashemi, explains.
With this conference, what we're trying to do is to unite with perspectives from the alternative media and to try to expand, well, you know, our slogan at Press TV, being the voice of the voiceless, where we want to make sure that voice of the voiceless is getting louder and louder. And we're hoping with the cooperation with, we have people here from over 45 countries, that we can make it happen.
An important issue that was also highlighted by the Iranian president's wife, who was the keynote speaker at the panel discussion of the festival, as well as the president himself, who held a meeting with the visiting journalists.
In different arenas in this media war, where there are different versions of the same stories, it is important to give voice to journalists who are telling the true stories. In many cases, strong and brave women are doing exactly that.
And the participants are already on board.
Just as Mrs. Alam Al Huda, the president's wife, explained today, we live in a world where there is a hegemony on news, and certain news outlets tell the entire world what the problems are and what the solutions should be. And that has become a norm.
In this venue, you know, we have a situation where we can hear the voices of the voiceless from around the world, basically. We have people from Latin America, we have people from Africa, from Asia, from America. So here it's a good opportunity to start a project that can break that norm, basically, that colonialized norm. We are looking forward to a new future.
Met with the support of a huge number of independent journalists, the Secretariat announced that this festival will be held every 2 years.
The Khurshid Media Festival is an effort to bring together women journalists from across the world to cover important issues and to give a voice to voices that have been muffled by mainstream media. Gisum Shahmadi, Mashhad.
In the past few presidential elections, the number one voter demand has been to address housing issues, which are suffered by one out of every four people in France. Many consider the European refugee crisis to be in its eighth year, adding to the national housing policy failure. The failure of Western sanctions on Russia has helped rent to explode over the last year by over 7%, or an entire monthly payment. Major demonstrations were held across the country to demand the government finally take action for adequate and stable shelter.
The government isn't proposing any solutions for these people with housing problems or who are completely homeless. These are people who work, who pay their taxes, and yet still find themselves on the streets. It's a big, big problem, but we don't expect anything from this government, given how they responded to the fair requests of the Yellow Vests.
Demonstrators demanded rent freezes and reductions, the taxing of real estate corporations and multiple homeowners, and the requisitioning of a record 3.2 million empty lodgings. However, historically, there have been few signs that the administration of Emmanuel Macron is interested in dialogue. The 2024 budget has just been released, but don't expect to see it debated in Parliament. President Macron has just used his usual executive decree to force through yet another austerity budget with billions in cuts to government services despite the record economic hardship.
Macron uses the 49.3 executive decree so the people remain silent. People are scared, and that's now our biggest problem. This fear has led to inaction and political apathy. And that's even though I hear everyone around me relating how bad things are going for them and for society. I don't understand their inaction, but I do understand their fear of getting involved, given the massive repression and lack of democracy here.
Many say that housing is actually an issue which any committed government can fix in just a few years. By making laws which favor tenants and not rich landlords, by putting more taxes into building public housing, and by creating more shelters for those with emergency needs. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As India gears up to hold the world's largest electoral exercise due in February 2024, violence against Muslims and other minorities has flared up across the country. Reports say the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, and its affiliated groups are responsible for the escalating trend. Observers say the hate has reached even the parliament, which many describe as a temple of democracy.
This is something unusual in our country. The politics of hate has reached even schools, colleges and universities. Few weeks ago, I was literally terrified when some people pulled my dress on the street outside college.
Violence against Muslims has prevailed since the partition in 1947. That's when the subcontinent was partitioned into two independent nation-states, Hindu-majority India and Muslim-majority Pakistan. But with the emergence of the ruling BJP in 2014, the situation has become far worse. Muslims have witnessed systematic repression against the community, including hate speeches, hate crimes and mob lynchings. A recent incident inside the Indian parliament sparked outrage when the BJP lawmaker hurled Islamophobic profanities while debating with a fellow Muslim lawmaker. In another horrific incident, a Muslim man was lynched in New Delhi for taking a banana at Hindu temple event.
I have a hard time selling vegetables on the streets now. A few months ago, I was harassed in a community, with many saying we won't buy vegetables from a Muslim. They called me by inappropriate names.
Since last decade, India has seen a growing fear and panic among minorities, particularly Muslims. There is a growing mistrust on the ruling BJP and its policies towards Muslims. The ruling party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, however, denies any allegation, saying India is a democracy and believes in equal rights for all. But critics argue that the real agenda is to promote Hindu supremacy in the country to garner votes and retain power.
With general elections few months away, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring up across the country. Minority communities are yet again becoming political tools for electoral gains. Experts say the ruling party is dividing voters on religious lines, which they say could lead to social discord in a country known as the world's largest democracy. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
In the limelight.
It's no secret there is a serious homelessness problem in the United States, which has assumed alarming proportions in recent years, from rough sleeping to being chronically homeless to living in crowded makeshift accommodations. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. TV noted, a quick trip through any major American city and you can see it for yourself. Tent cities, underneath highways or alongside parks, people sleeping on the sidewalk, overcrowded and resource-stripped shelters. It is estimated that there are nearly 600,000 homeless people across the U.S., marking the highest yearly surge since the government began tracking the data in 2007, according to the Wall Street Journal. Major cities like Los Angeles are seeing homeless populations spike almost 10% from last year. This problem has been deeply exacerbated in the post-pandemic era. Prior to the COVID-19 outbreak, rent was already skyrocketing due to inflation levels, as well as development projects forcing long-time residents, mainly minorities, out of their own neighborhoods. The pandemic halted the U.S. economy, at least for the working class, for several months, and thus rent protections had to be placed primarily across the state levels. With Americans out of jobs and back pay piling up on rent, the then Donald Trump administration released three rounds of stimulus checks over the course of a year, totaling around $3,200 for most individuals. Deeply insufficient, this rent would likely only cover 1 month's worth of rent in most major cities. The average monthly rent for a one-bedroom New York City apartment is just over $2,000. The Biden administration focused on returning things back to normal and beating the pandemic, mostly for a political goal, without addressing the reality that millions of Americans face. Not only did rent protections come crashing down without addressing the hundreds of millions of dollars owed in back pay, but the Biden administration cut essential benefits like SNAP benefits, which kicked millions off food stamps. A study showed these benefits reduce poverty by 10% and even child poverty by 14%. Declaring the end of the pandemic and the victory over COVID-19 was no doubt a political victory for the Biden administration, but in doing so, it forced thousands of Americans out of their homes and into the streets. The COVID-era protections, which prove the federal government is capable of working with the state governments to fight poverty and protect people, did not put things back to normal, but returned thousands of people to the same issues with worse conditions. Adding to the diminishing conditions is the threat of a looming recession. Inflation has driven up the cost of basic living in the United States: groceries, gas, electricity. So while SNAP benefits are being cut, costs of the very same items those benefits were helping ordinary Americans out with are rising. Then comes the blame game. Federal authorities shift the blame to local authorities and local policy failures when it comes to the rapidly growing homeless population. Local authorities blame the lack of federal leadership in curtailing the nationwide issue. Perhaps the only people taking serious steps to fight the homelessness crisis are average, everyday Americans. Groups like Bring Chicago Home take a multi-pronged approach to addressing homelessness crisis at a local level. Creating a policy that would house the 65,000 homeless people living in Chicago, the group has also disrupted then-Mayor Lori Lightfoot multiple times throughout various meetings, demanding that she take action. Their tactics so far have been a success. Now, Mayor Brandon Johnson has adopted the Bring Chicago Home initiative, using real estate taxes for programs to end homelessness. The success of these policies is yet to be seen, but this initiative would not have seen the light of day if it weren't for community organizations. A similar community pushback is also seen in New York. The New York City Rent Board intended to pass a 2 to 5% rent increase across major areas of the city. Local activists stormed the stage with city council members to demand the increase be stopped. Instead of hearing what renters have to say, New York City Mayor Adams supported the decision of the board and the rent hike was passed. Throughout major metropolitan cities from liberal California all the way to conservative Florida, it has been the same story over and over again. It is indeed a stark reality. Americans who are themselves struggling and living paycheck to paycheck are the ones taking care of each other and fighting for each other. It may seem like the issue is beyond Washington's grasp, but the reality is that if it wanted to, Washington could solve the homelessness issue overnight. There are currently 16 million homes completely vacant across the United States. With only 500,000 homeless people, there is more than plenty of housing available for the homeless. One could argue that these homes are not exactly where there are homeless people, but that is not true. A good chunk of these homes are within the city limits of most major cities, and even then, a relocation program would not cost much at all. Speaking of things that do not cost much, solving the homelessness issue itself would cost very little. According to advocacy to alleviate homelessness, it would cost just over $20 billion to end the crisis. In isolation, this amount seems like a lot, but let's look at how the Biden administration has spent money. $43 billion on military aid alone to Ukraine. This omits billions of dollars in financial aid, food aid, logistics, etc. $10 billion on federal stimulus to bolster already militarized police. $80 billion on public prisons and jails. The money spent on policing and prisons is worth taking particular notice of, as homelessness itself is treated as a crime. Even in the freezing winter, law enforcement across the U.S. often engage in mass sweeps of homeless camps, tearing down tents, and throwing away what little personal belongings they have. Politicians and some business owners in various areas complain that the tents and homeless people themselves aren't attractive and prevent people from coming to their towns or businesses. Ironically, it's often these very businesses that drive the cost of living in an area and price people out of their homes. So, instead of alleviating the crisis through fixed price renting, the solution taken on by local authorities is to not only evict people from their homes, but drive them from the area completely. The Chicago Coalition for the Homeless reports, in the past few months, we have witnessed city crews threaten to ticket people for sleeping on the sidewalk in uptown, force elderly and disabled people to move their property in the middle of the winter for no apparent reason, bulldoze a tent city while seizing tents that looked almost new and recently occupied, and attempt to seize the tent of a homeless man who was present and asserting that the tent belonged to him. The threat of homelessness is not going away in the United States. As the economy dwindles and more Americans are forced into living paycheck to paycheck, federal to state governments throw money at criminalization of the homeless instead of actually solving homelessness. The authorities believe that homelessness can't be an issue if nobody sees it. But the reality is everyone sees it. It is a societal crisis. Many feel that they could be next, as more than half of Americans are one paycheck away from homelessness. And with the cost of living skyrocketing, saving money is also becoming a challenge. With real leadership that values human life over profits, perhaps one day Americans will be able to solve the homelessness crisis. But until then, they should not rely on their current political leadership, whether Democrat or Republican, to do anything substantial. The only way forward is for the American people to organize together and take an offensive approach to solving their own problems.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The mainstream Western media has once again staged a propaganda campaign against Iran, this time following an incident for a 16-year-old Iranian female student at a Tehran subway station. Armi Tagheravan collapsed in a metro station on Sunday, October the 1st. The anti-Iran media outlets were quick to blame the Iranian security forces for the incident, but credible testimonies and published videos, including the CCTV footage, suggests otherwise.
16-year-old Armi Tagheravand fainted while boarding a train at a subway station in the Iranian capital. Immediately afterwards, anti-Iran TV channels and outlets embarked on a media campaign blaming the incident on the subway police. They accused the police of pushing Armita out of the train after a noisy argument leading to her fall. Now the Tehran subway company has released all camera footage from the moment Armita enters the station till she is taken to hospital. Here is 6:52 a.m., October 1st. Armita enters the station alone. After 2 minutes, she passes the ticket control gate. At 6:54, she enters a grocery store in the station, and after that she is seen here heading to the platform, where she catches up with her friends. It can be seen that the whole 8 minutes of her presence in the station passes without a problem. Armita and her friends wait to board the train, but they don't take the first one. It seems they are waiting for a friend. Armita's arrival on the platform and her boarding take more than 8 minutes. Still no scene or any problem. And Armita and her friends board the train, but after just 4 seconds, she gets dizzy and falls down. After Armita's fall, people on the scene call the emergency services and try to revive her. A couple of minutes into the incident, medical teams arrive and she's transported to the nearest hospital. Armita's close friends say there was no quarrel and it was simply a normal day to school.
Her head hit the ground. I tried to pull her to safety with the help of others. When my hand touched her head, there was blood. We brought her out. Let me say this. Nothing happened on the train. No one pushed her. No one quarreled with her. Nothing. The moment she got on the train, she just fell.
Armita is now in hospital, and according to her medical report, she has gone through low blood pressure. Armita's parents say they have not seen any irregularities in the camera footage provided by the subway company or her medical report. They have called for people to pray for their daughter's health.
I've seen the subway footage, and I don't think what some people say is true.
I've seen all the footage and followed it closely. Nothing was wrong.
Last year, similar media tactics employed by the anti-Iran news outlets incited violence throughout the country. Yet the misinformation campaign has only failed.
Well, joining us in our studios here in Tehran, our correspondent Gisli Misha Ahmadi, who had visited the medical center where Armita is hospitalized, is here to give us more details. Gisu, it's great to have you with us. What details can you share with us and our viewers?
Well, before I tell you about the experience I had today going to the hospital to find out more about Armita Bardia, first I'd like to clarify that for anyone living in Iran and in Tehran, it is absolutely absurd to hear that there was some kind of police or whatever, security officer or whatever, to confront someone for particularly the way they are dressed inside the metro station. This is something that has never happened ever in the history of Iran's metro, particularly because there are special wagons for women, and women are usually free to dress the way they want to inside those wagons. So, you know, this particular detail is really disturbing for anyone who lives in Tehran and who uses the metro, which I happen to be one of those people, and I use the metro very often. So putting that aside, I had the opportunity to go to the hospital today, and I was allowed to go all the way upstairs to the intensive care unit where Armita is actually there. I was able to talk to her father. Her mother and her sister just left for the city of Mashhad, the holy city of Mashhad, where Imam Reza's holy shrine is located. It is traditional for Iranians, whenever they have any problems, they usually go there to pray and ask Imam Reza to help them and bless them and, of course, grant them their wishes. Obviously, Armita's family are under a lot of pressure right now. And what makes the ordeal even tougher, Bardia, is the fact that they have to deal with all of these media reports and, of course, reporters who are calling them from here and there, trying to figure out what's happening. So on the one hand, they're already under a lot of pressure because of their daughter, who is now in intensive care unit. And like I said, the mother is away with the sister in the holy city of Mashhad to pray for her to get well soon. And on the other hand, they have all of this commotion coming from anti-Iran media outlets who have been once again able to create a story out of thin air. And for anyone who watches the CCTV footage, it is quite obvious that nothing happened and it was just an accident, and whatever it was, it had to do with Armita's health herself. She was not pushed. She was not confronted by anyone. She was accompanied by her friends on her way to school, as she would do every day. And of course, I will be talking to the medical staff tomorrow, and I will be giving you more details about that tomorrow, where they will be explaining exactly what happened to her.
All right, thanks a lot. Gisu Misha Ahmadi joining us in our studios here in Tehran. Also joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. And also joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, human rights lawyer and peace activist Daniel Kovalik.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magnier in Brussels. Sir, how do you view this recent incident, which has led to many Western-backed media outlets to start their anti-Iran narratives? What's the reason for such a rush to demonize Iranian security forces in the first place?
Thank you for having me. It is obvious that Iran is under the microscope, and on the first occasion, on the first small incident, you have immediately the mainstream media jumping on it and just transforming it, quoting, and that's not journalism really, quoting a Kurdish source in Norway, an activist in Norway, reporting about what's happening in the metro in Tehran, when there are the footage of CCTV showing a man coming in the wagon just a few seconds before after the Armita went in, and then just staying by the door to see how the girlfriend came out. So there is no manipulation of the video. But on the other hand, we understand that it took them a year in the mainstream media and those manipulators to find something that they can blame Iran and try to reproduce exactly the same story or similar to the story that came out a year ago for Mahsa Amini, and to accuse Iran of violating human rights, etc., and all these excuses that normally here in the West we love to accuse Iran of, or any other country that is not submitted to the Western hegemony. So, I mean, I'm surprised it took a year to regain all the aggressive campaign against Iran, and that has been going on since 1979 in different forms. But because the West has mastered the art of manipulation of the media and the footage and the use of the social media and mainstream media to take advantage of it, so it shows how they are really waiting by the second, by the minute, by the hour to grab the first opportunity that can inspire them to create a story out of it. And honestly, it's always the same reason. Iran is not submitted to the West, and Iran is demonized for the last 43 years and will continue to be so. So I'm not surprised if we see another story coming up in the next month, depending what they find, really.
Daniel Kovalik, what do you make of this recent episode of anti-Iran propaganda? And in addition to that, can you tell us who benefits in general from such anti-Iran campaigns? What are the motives behind these campaigns?
Well, first of all, my reaction is, you know, I live in the United States. The police in the United States kill over 1,000 people a year. We have incredibly violent streets. In New York City, it's not, you know, uncommon that someone will be, you know, pushed by someone into the subway and killed. The point is, I don't want to sound insensitive, but I have to respond. I don't get it. Like, that people would be calling for action against Iran for this is incredible. Again, given what you could find in the U.S. on any daily basis, that is 100 times worse than this. Now, who does this benefit? Obviously, it benefits people in the State Department who want to overthrow the Iranian government. The U.S. has wanted to overthrow the Iranian government since 1979. It successfully overthrew the Iranian government in 1953 and installed the Shah, and then it's been upset ever since 1979 when the Shah was ousted in a popular revolution. So there's many in Washington that would like to find reasons to cause public unrest in Iran. Obviously, there are people within Iran and Iranians outside Iran who would like to engage in regime change. You have the MEK, for example. That's been involved in regime change activities for a long time, so they might benefit from this. But again, these are the old-fashioned techniques used by in particular, the U.S. intelligence agencies like the CIA to try to foment regime change. Like, actually, they used similar tactics against Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. So it's not surprising. But again, this incident seems hardly the type of incident you could latch on to create regime change. But I don't know. I've been surprised by other things. So.
Elijah Magnea, the United States and its allies, they constantly demonize Iran. The continuation of these hostile and provocative policies against Iran are believed to be trying to stoke Iranophobia and promoting a propaganda campaign against the Islamic Republic. Where does this hostility from Washington towards Iran stem from? Is it because of maybe Israel's interests, or is it the fact that Iran is an independent country in the region and that really irritates the U.S.?
Well, it all starts from the Iranian constitution, where it is clearly cited that Iran supports all the oppressed people around the world, and the Iranian cause is never forget the central cause, that is the Palestinian cause and their right of return to their homeland and recover their occupied territory. By saying, by taking out these 2 points, Iran becomes the enemy, because Iran is the enemy of the Israelis who occupy the Palestinian land. And Iran is supporting all those who want to fight against the U.S. And its allies, imperialism in the Middle East and anywhere else. Iran has supported the Palestinian, the Lebanese Hezbollah in Syria, Iraq, in Venezuela, and Iran, part of the Shanghai Cooperation, will also be part of the BRICS in January. So all this activity and Iranian wealth in natural resources increases the appetite of the West to attack Iran, demonize it, and bring it to submission, particularly when Iran is refusing that, and its model is giving also an example to other countries like China, Russia, Latin America, Africa, who wants to stand against the U.S. hegemony. And Iran has been doing that for the last 43 years and still surviving, and that pushed Iran to depend on its own in almost a lot of things and a lot of needs, and particularly in the military aspect. So because of that, Iran will always be demonized. Iran will always be attacked. The Iranian progress in the nuclear program and the peaceful nuclear program is creating even more havoc in the West. How Iran can reach such a level of scientific knowledge and advanced in technology, advanced in weaponry, and having more than 3,500 sanctions on it for the last decades. So all that is really putting the West in a position where other countries can follow the same model or can find other alternative to rely on other allies rather than the U.S. and its allies. Because of that, and because of Iran is really putting obstacles in front of the American plans and planning in the Middle East, and in particularly in Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, because of that, it is costing the Americans a lot to try and keep their position and not to look like a fool or incompetent or not strong as they want to look like. And on top of that, Iran is the only country just after the Second World War that dared to bomb the U.S. in Ain al-Assad military base in Anbar in Iraq following the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. Because of that, it's enough excuses to demonize Iran all the time.
Daniel Kovalev, let's talk a little bit about the media hypocrisy. Media outlets, social media networks, which often caution against jumping the gun on spreading news too soon or without decisive evidence, they seem to act the opposite when it comes to Iran. Why is that?
No, I think that's right. Iran is guilty till proven innocent. And again, because there is this demonization that's been happening with Iran. And again, since the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iran has just been portrayed incessantly and relentlessly in the U.S. press as some sort of insane dictatorial nation. When in fact, you know, in the region, it's frankly one of the more enlightened countries. I've been there, and you know, I was there in 2017, was very impressed by it, by the culture, by the intellectual milieu of the country. But that's not what you learn about in the United States. It's been vilified. The leaders have been vilified. And so they're very quick to blame Iran for anything. And again, that's also because they're parroting the views that are being pushed by Washington in their effort to overthrow the government, you know, and sometimes it's successful, these types of vilification campaigns. I mean, what comes to mind is Libya. You know, since I was a child, Muammar Gaddafi was portrayed as this crazy man, this mad dog. I think that's what Reagan referred to him, that needed to be overthrown. And he ultimately was, you know, and look at what that country is now. It's been torn asunder. It's now three separate countries, essentially, now, and slaves are being sold on the streets. And I guess if the U.S. had its way, that's what would happen with Iran. And, you know, so it's very dangerous, this type of vilification campaign that the press is engaged in.
Sure. Elijah Magni, same question to you. Talking about this hypocrisy in the media, this demonization, it's been proven through and through against Iran. Press TV, our very own channel, has paid the price for challenging the global media dominance of Western news outlets as the U.S. seized the website domain of Press TV. In the past, we've faced growing restrictions on our platforms. We were removed from broadcasting satellites. What's your reaction here?
Well, if we take the example of Press TV, we take the example of Julian Assange, anyone who's writing about the truth is no longer accepted. We've seen that in the war in Syria and how the mainstream media reacted unprofessionally. And we thought that journalism has some values and some respect to the profession to be really taking the news and the truth as it is, and to give it to the reader. Unfortunately, this is continuing throughout the years. We've seen also how they covered the war in Iraq, they covered the war in Libya, they covered the war in Syria, and they're covering the Palestinian saga and cause. So all that is a double standard. Doesn't come only from the media. It comes from the European leaders and Western leaders who have double standard and who have a very high level of hypocrisy in any matter they are dealing with. So they turn things to their advantage, things that are accepted for one country, they're not accepted for another country. So there is no more professionalism in our profession. Today, anyone can write anything, quote any source, like in case of Armita, quoting someone in a human activist in Norway, a Kurdish human activist in Norway, or we don't have the name, we don't know how he can testify and be testimony. So even Reuters quoting only two sources, unnamed sources. So everybody jumped on the story in a very unprofessional